in which the theme of the program is, okay, how we doing? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, the 16th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So, here we are on a Friday, mid-spring, after a year of a pandemic. The economic mood seems to be changing, so let's discuss, shall we? Catherine Rampell is at the Washington Post. David Gura is here as well. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Catherine, let me start with you, and I'm going to point out a couple of things, and then I want your response. Number one, retail sales, we learned this week, way up. Housing starts bouncing back. I was talking to a guy last night who works at a big Wall Street bank, and he said he and his bank are, and this is a quote, very bullish. It is difficult. I think you have to look pretty hard to find the dark clouds out there. Discuss.
Yes, certainly. The numbers look excellent so far. The GDP expectations for the first quarter of this year are expected to be something like 5 or 6% annualized, the last I checked, which is a far cry from last fall when, or end of last year anyway, when a number of analysts were expecting a decline in GDP this first quarter. So things look quite good. Lots of good news. I think the result of a confluence of factors, including, of course, vaccinations picking up, fiscal support, reopening of schools in some places around the country, which has allowed parents to return to work, etc. The one thing that I would be worried about, of course, is a resurgence of infections. If, for example, we don't get as much throughput because the J&J vaccine is still on pause, or people are worried about vaccines and the variants, you know, do their thing and infect a lot more people, then all of that could at least be partly reversed. I'd like to think that we've turned away from the corner far away enough that, you know, that there's a lot of momentum right now, but there are some risks out
there,
certainly.
Well, Mr. Gura, acknowledging that the virus is actually still in control of this economy, I want you to take the flip side of that conversation and find me the dark sides. And the first word out of your mouth best not be inflation, because that's too easy.
We'll get to that in a little bit. But I think the point of comparison for us today is still how things were before the pandemic set in. And employment is something to think, I think, is still of concern. Yes, we saw indications that there were fewer layoffs recently, that the labor market's improving. But if you look at how many jobs there are today versus how many there were before this thing, there's still a deficit of many million. And that's something that's still concerning, certainly, to the Fed and to other policymakers. And we had the Fed chairman sort of set the table for us a few days ago. He did an interview with 60 Minutes, and he equivocated, as he often does, and he's so expert at doing. He said, the outlook has brightened substantially, but like Catherine, he's very cognizant of the fact that this recovery has been driven in large part by the disease. He's been frank, forthright about that since all of this began. You know, economists have had to fashion themselves as epidemiologists in a way. They've had to follow the trajectory of this virus, and that's still very much the case. Catherine mentioned GDP. We're not quite where we were but before all of this set in. And even when you look at inflation indicators, to close with that, the point of comparison still is how things were before the epidemic began.
Catherine, David mentioned labor, and I want to relate two stories. One is I had a guy on the program the other day who's a boat builder up in Maine, and he said, you know, we're having supply chain issues, but he also said, I just can't hire enough people. Point one. Point two, I put an interview in the can this morning with the CEO of Chipotle, and he said one of his big problems is finding people. We are still down 8.5 million jobs from the before times, as David mentioned. How can it possibly be that people are having a tough time finding people to hire?
Well, there are a few reasons. One, of course, is that it is still risky to take many of these jobs. And in fact, if you look at the Census Household Pulse Survey data, it shows that there are, I think, a couple of million people, I forget the exact number, who have said, part of the reason I don't have a job is that I'm worried about getting sick. So again, until we have mass vaccination, something approaching herd immunity or what have you, it's still going to be less attractive to take jobs. There are concerns, of course, about the generosity of unemployment benefits, that maybe those are also making it easier for people to stay out of re-employment. Now, the evidence on that is mixed. The studies that had been put together last summer that looked at this question, of course, the labor market dynamics were a little bit different, mm-hmm. but they did not find any evidence at the time that the generosity of unemployment benefits was in fact holding people back from the labor force. But you could imagine there might be some people who were on the fence who were saying, hey, that job I've been offered, it seems risky. I don't want to get sick. I don't have my vaccine yet. Maybe I can hold out a little bit longer because of the, you know, the safety net is allowing me to make that choice. And I'm not sure that that would necessarily be a bad thing, but that could be a factor.
Yeah. Hey, David, we talked about or you talked about Sherpal a minute ago. I want to turn to another member of the organization known as the Federal Reserve. The president of the San Francisco Fed, Mary Daly, said in a seminar the other day, or in a webinar, I guess we're calling it now. She said, look, the Fed can't keep being the first line of defense. Right. And Neil Irwin wrote about this in the New York Times a number of weeks ago, how, you know, maybe what's happening is we're having a shift from the Fed being first line of defense to lawmakers and legislators realizing the political gains that can come with some financial largesse in times of crisis. I wonder what you think of that.
Yeah, Mary Daly doing a bit of a postmortem here, and it was an interesting speech. She brought up her childhood in Missouri, you know, that there were floods, bad floods, but they were regular things. And she cautioned that the Fed can't be the institution that people go to whenever there's a crisis or something that's a problem, but maybe not quite a crisis yet. And I think that that's something that she wants to chew over. I think a lot of policymakers want to chew over. If you look at this last year, I think it would widely be agreed upon that a success story is how quickly the Fed moved when things started to look bad, when markets started to tank, and we started to get our hands around how big a deal this outbreak, this pandemic was going to be. She's proposing, I think, more of a postmortem look at sort of how things are constructed systemically, making sure that, you know, when things go bad, there are more structures in place that would make it so that you wouldn't necessarily have to go to the Fed first thing. We'll see where that goes. It sounds like that's in an early stage of just looking at sort of the way that the Fed and the systems are set up.
Yeah, and of course, the politics of Congress trying to fix this economy are moving
slightly more slowly than the Fed did.
David Gura, also Catherine Rempel, thanks. You two have yourselves a nice weekend, all right?
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. On Wall Street today, well, you know, it was more up than down, but not a whole lot of enthusiasm. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There have been some economic bright spots in this pandemic. Groceries and supermarkets, it turns out, are one of them. Not for food so much as for the real estate of it. Aldi, Food Lion, and Lidl have expansion plans in the works, and the big chains were expanding before the pandemic as well. More than 2,500 new grocery stores with footprints of 5,000 square feet or more have opened in the past 5 years. That's from the commercial real estate group CoStar. So Marketplace's Kristen Schwab explains how commercial landlords might have to lean on grocers as other companies think about opting out of their leases.
This story doesn't start with the pandemic grocery boom. It starts with the downturn of in-person shopping. For years, landlords have been losing big tenants like Toys R Us, Office Depot, and Bed Bath & Beyond. Alexander Levy is with the CoStar Group.
Either they have to subdivide that space to put in smaller tenants, or they need to find a larger tenant that is more stable.
Enter grocery stores. For landlords, they're pretty recession-proof, so they're going to pay the rent. They sign long leases up to 20 years, and they bring a lot of foot traffic to strip malls. Scott Burns at commercial real estate firm JLL says stores like Aldi and Trader Joe's are increasingly a good match for spaces being vacated by mid-size retailers.
You know, 20 years ago, grocery stores were on average 40 to 50,000 square feet. Majority of the grocery stores these days are 20 to 30,000 feet and coming down.
But if landlords rely too much on grocery, will there be too many of them? Mark Thompson is founder of groceryanchored.com.
Yeah, there's certainly places across the country where we're seeing overstored locations, other places where the expansion needs to happen.
He says it takes about 15,000 residents to support one grocery store. Some places like North Carolina have a much higher ratio of stores to people.
Now, who won? Well, the consumer won, because all these grocery stores were competing for consumers at that point. It dropped prices.
That bubble burst. Some local chains filed for bankruptcy and closed locations, leaving landlords in the lurch again. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
The pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has complicated an already difficult logistics exercise at the macro health policy level and at the micro get people their shots level, too. So spare a thought here, if you would, for the people and the businesses on the sharp end of the needle, pharmacies in particular. Endless phone calls from people trying to make appointments, not enough staff, people who skip appointments or think one dose is enough, no matter the brand name you're getting. It's all the more difficult, all of that, if you run a small independent pharmacy, as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra tells us.
When I talked to Amber Kaluskar on a video call last week, he looked and sounded tired.
I'm definitely working probably close to 70 to 80 hours a week. And when I'm not working, I'm just constantly thinking about it.
Kaluskar is a pharmacist at his family's business, Rossi Pharmacy, in East New York, a neighborhood in Brooklyn. He's at home, tying up loose ends from the 300 patients who showed up for the pharmacy's last vaccination clinic.
We've been working around the clock to make sure that we enter all the paperwork by the deadlines.
I stopped by the pharmacy a couple days later. The customer area is tiny, maybe 150 square feet. Just enough room for a glass case filled with bottles of Tylenol and Flintstone vitamins, and for a few people to stand six-ish feet apart. Kaluskar takes me through a door and down a narrow hallway lined with chairs. This is where they do vaccinations. They have the Moderna.
This area was never actually, you know, meant to keep patients there, but we adapted.
Because the pharmacy is so small, it's also been holding vaccine clinics at community centers. Sometimes people don't show up for their appointments.
Thankfully, we've never had to waste any vaccines, but yeah, there are some days where I have to wait on the site an extra hour, hour and a half for those last doses to get used.
These clinics are exhausting for the pharmacists, partly because they end up having the same conversation dozens of times.
You know, hey, come on back. How are you doing? How are things going? And then explaining like what vaccine they're getting and talking them through the side effects.
That's Rebecca Larman, a pharmacist at Shriver's Pharmacy and Wellness in Athens, Ohio. It mostly has Moderna vaccines. She gets that these conversations are important, but
sometimes I feel like a robot saying the same thing over and over again.
And sometimes she sounds like a robot. If you encounter this when you're getting your vaccine, remember, your pharmacist has been at this all day.
They might be hungry, they might have to pee, or they might just be struggling, right?
There's a lot of pressure on healthcare workers to get this right. Make sure the vaccines are stored correctly, that no one's having an allergic reaction, that they're answering everyone's questions. About 150 miles away, at Heart Pharmacy in Cincinnati, Sarah Priestley is right in the thick of it.
All right, right or left arm, sir?
Should it be one you don't use as often?
Okay. Well, so there's some theory that the dominant arm is better because you're going to move that more.
Priestley's grandfather opened this pharmacy in 1960. Inside, the walls are paneled with wood, and a flying pig, the Cincinnati mascot, hangs from the ceiling. Priestley, who owns the pharmacy now, has started making house calls, too. She just vaccinated a woman who couldn't come to the pharmacy and hadn't seen her grandkids all year because of the pandemic.
And I think it brought her a lot of comfort and a feeling of that she was going to get some of that part of her life back.
The conversations Priestley is having with customers have gotten more complicated because of the pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. That's the one Heart Pharmacy has been administering. When the news came on Tuesday, Priestley had to cancel everyone's appointments. Right now, there have been six cases of blood clots reported out of 6.8 million doses.
I do understand that we need to assess safety, but it does make me worry that the vaccine hesitancy that already was there is going to be more pronounced.
She says a lot of medications can cause rare but serious side effects, and it's about weighing the risks and benefits. That's what she's going to tell her customers. In the meantime, she just got word that she'll be getting a shipment of Moderna vaccines. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
You wake up Monday morning, you want to know what's going on in business and economics. Might I recommend one at David Brancaccio and his staff on the Marketplace Morning Report? They will hook you up. Coming up.
I'm still not going to get my hair cut.
Yeah, let's see how long you hold out, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 164 on this Friday, almost a half percent, finished at 34,200 on the nose. The NASDAQ picked up 13 points, about a tenth percent, 14,052. The S&P 500 added 15 points, three-tenths percent, landed at 41.85. For the week, the Dow up just shy of 1 2/10%. The NASDAQ picked up 1 1/10. S&P 500 pocketed just under 1 4/10%. So it is Friday, as I believe I've said once or twice. And come on, isn't everybody dreaming of getting away someplace? That's some foreshadowing for you. Stay tuned for the rest of the program. But on the theme of vacations, Marriott International down 3/10% today. Hilton Worldwide and Hyatt both picked up 6/10%. Airlines, you say? Sure. American, Delta, and United all down around 4/10%. Southwest fell almost 9/10%. Over at the rental car concourse, Avis Budget Group picked up about 1 1/4%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back a year or so ago when things were looking not real good for this economy, we got a group of people together who study economic history.
My name is Kathleen Day.
My name is Carola Friedman.
My name is Eric Hilt.
You remember our panel, right? Kathleen Day teaches at Johns Hopkins, Carola Friedman is at Northwestern, and Eric Hilt is at Wellesley. And we asked them, and remember, a year ago, to help us understand a historical comparison that a lot of people were making at the time.
The reason that the Great Depression was the Great Depression was that the financial system essentially melted down. And for the most part, the Fed did very little to try to stop that.
Banks by the hundreds, by the thousands, are forced to close.
This time, it's obviously not man-made. It's a virus.
There has been a lesson learned from the Great Depression.
So, panel, 1 year later, where are we?
I'm a little bit afraid to step on a scale.
I'm still not going to get my hair cut.
I have a vaccine appointment, which I'm excited about.
I have a young child. I don't envision my child to be vaccinated for quite some time.
True for millions of parents out there. But next question, how are we feeling about the economy?
I feel pretty good.
Things are looking up.
We're still quite a ways away from where we were in February 2020.
There's still a lot of people who are hungry.
But there's been a lot of improvement.
There's been a lot of improvement, basically because policymakers learned from the mistakes of not doing enough last time round. Trillions of dollars in relief checks and unemployment benefits and small business loans. About 60% of the 22 million jobs we lost the past year have come back. And now, with more vaccines going into more arms every day and all the talk about pent-up demand, there is a different historical comparison to be made.
The 1920s.
The 1920s.
The 1920s, in so many ways, is relevant now in both how it's similar and how it isn't.
All right, explain.
One of the reasons why we talk about the 1920s now is because it's the decade right after the 1918 pandemic.
Yeah, that was only one of the reasons.
The 1920s began with a deep recession in 1920-21, which followed the turmoil of the World War I years.
What we see later on is a series of reasons that make the economy really, really grow.
In the 1920s, the great American word was prosperity.
Some of them have to do with real fundamentals.
Even though radio and cars and telephones had been around in 1910, they really took off.
The population got much more educated.
It was the first time in the United States that there were more people living in cities than on farms.
When people think about the 1920s, they probably imagine wild parties with bootleg liquor at like Jay Gatsby's house. And, you know, the end of the pandemic could see some of that, right? I'd certainly like to go to a party at a house like that. It's been a while.
I don't know.
There are some parts of the Roaring Twenties that I hope they do not come back.
This is a period of tremendous inequality with a large proportion of total income going to the very top.
Of course, the 20s ended differently than they started.
With the stock market crash of 29 that, of course, ended up leading into the Great Depression.
The great big spree, the jazz age, is over. All over.
To be clear, nobody is saying we're headed for a 1920s-like boom with an inevitable bust at the end. The Fed now takes an active role in managing the economy. There is deposit insurance and a social safety net. The economy is fundamentally different today than it was back then.
So I think the transformation in what life looked like between 1920 and 1929 was much more dramatic than what our lives are going to change from 2021 to 2029.
So what are we going to see?
I do think we're going to see a consumer boom, but I think it's going to be slower than we expect.
Just because there's a lot of surface optimism and encouraging activity, don't forget to look to see if there's underlying cracks in the economy and what's causing them.
And it could be that some elements of our society may not share in the prosperity that we may very likely experience over the next few years.
Thanks again to Kathleen Day at Johns Hopkins, Eric Hilt at Wellesley, and Carola Friedman at Northwestern for once again taking us back into the economic past. We will check back in maybe once this pandemic is history as well. How about that? The Centers for Disease Control says that as of 2 days ago, almost 125 million people have gotten at least one vaccine shot in this country. And you know what that is? Other than really good news, that's a business opportunity is what that is, especially if you are in the travel business. Searches for domestic flights for this coming summer have gone up nearly 60% in the past month. That's according to the travel site Hopper. Google searches for hotels hit a 10-year high this month, and searches for plan a trip to Disney World increased, I kid you not, 2,600% from March to April. And forget about getting a rental car whenever you get wherever you are going. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports on what travel pent-up demand looks like.
Joylyn Ankeny and her husband are ridiculously excited to finally go on vacation.
The pent-up demand here in our own home to just leave the house and go do something is huge.
Ankeny is an accountant in Oregon, and recently, at the height of tax season,
I told my husband I needed plane tickets somewhere.
They decided on Tennessee. Flights were pretty cheap, she says, but rental cars?
That's going to be one of the most expensive parts of our trip.
They're also finding most places they're thinking of visiting require reservations now and seem to be booking up. That is true for all sorts of things, from Disneyland tickets to campsites. A lot of people, like Ankeny, are booking trips within the U.S. and, in many cases, staying relatively close to home. That's according to Christopher Nolte at Airbnb.
More than 70% of the searches that we're seeing are for destinations that are about 50 to 300 miles away from home for folks. So, you know, the sort of, I can get there on a tank of gas destination. And many of these are sort of in remote locations.
Many of the flights people are looking for and booking are also to more remote outdoorsy spots, says Adit Damodaran, an economist at the travel booking site Hopper.
National parks have done really well and beaches have done really well. That seems to be where a lot of the interest currently is.
And Damodaran says airlines have been adding flights to those kinds of destinations. Meanwhile, fares are starting to go up.
Prices went up about 12% in March alone.
And Damodaran expects they'll keep going up as summer gets closer and as more people book. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Elon Musk takes another step toward getting humanity off this planet. That is what the founder and CEO of SpaceX has said his ultimate aim is. Anyway, NASA announced today it has chosen SpaceX to design and build the spacecraft that is going to take us back to the moon. $2.9 billion is the contract as it stands right now. I'm going to take the over on that. Sadly, there's no timeline either. The Biden administration has said it's reviewing President Trump's 2024 date, but still, cool, right? All right, we got to go, but here's your moment of economic context to end the week, Global Trade Edition. Some reporting today out of the UK about a shortage of garden gnomes. Gardening's gotten very popular over there during the pandemic, it seems, and everybody's got to have a gnome, I guess. Which is fine. Lots of demand. But the chief executive of the Garden Centre Association in the UK also said this to the BBC. With goods arriving from abroad, garden centres were affected by the ship getting stuck in the canal. Garden furniture, ornaments, of which gnomes would be some, he went on, being stuck in containers trying to come over here. Garden gnomes and the ever given. You cannot make this stuff up. I love this story. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.